I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello and welcome to Off the Beat and Track Podcast. I'm your host, I'm Stu Whiffin. It's another week, therefore it's another episode. Today's episode, I sit down with Shane Embry of Napalm Death, and we have a delightful chat. And it's a real surprise. The record that we talk about today, I think when I first heard that I was going to be interviewing Shane, I did not think we'd be discussing some of the music that we do. But that's the beauty of music, and we have a lovely discussion about some fantastic records. And he's such an interesting guy, and I'm really looking forward to his here in this episode, and it's coming very soon, very, very soon. But just quickly, I have to do some thank yous. And I'd like to thank the team at Blue Murder Club Podcast. They produce this here podcast. And in their own right, they're a fantastic podcast. It's a true crime podcast. And they've had some fantastic guests as well. And some you may well recognize from the archives of this podcast. So go check that out, Blue Murder Club Podcast. Also, big thanks to Scroobius Pip. It's Mr. Pippi Kins that got me on this podcast journey, which was a happy accident that's completely changed the sort of course of my life, really, and that's led me to do Pod Bible, the magazine with Scroob, and it's podcasting's pretty much my full time job now, and it's been such a glorious journey, and no more so than Off the Beaten Track, which has seen me interview well over 500 people that. So many of which have been like people that I've grown up listening to or watching or laughing at when I've gone to see them play their stand-up shows and stuff. And so basically, if you are new to this podcast, as I've just alluded to there's over 500 episodes with all your favourite comedians, actors, musicians, DJs, producers. I won't list them because I've been so lucky, some of the most famous rock bands in the world, all of your great comedians and some absolute heavyweights of the acting industry. So go explore that back catalogue after you've listened to today's episode. I'd love it if you could support the podcast because I do this for love. There's no money involved in this podcast. I have no sponsors on this podcast. So if you enjoy this and you'd like to support it, I put together a Patreon and it's a quid a month. Well, it's not even a quid, it's a dollar, so it's less than a pound a month. And that's not just to support the podcast, but I give you lots of stuff as well over there. So if you do become a patron and you pay that dollar, you get to watch all the episodes. I put the videos up so you can get to watch all the episodes. I put up loads of mixtapes. There's a huge archive of radio shows and of unreleased episodes. And I also do a monthly hangout on Zoom where all the patrons come along and we talk about our favourite albums and things like that. And it's certainly not a too cool for school thing. It's there's some super embarrassing records in there. And we chat a different subject each month, and it's such a lovely bunch. And I'd love for more of you to come along and experience that. And that ticket to that all comes within your dollar a month. So I know times are tough, but if you can spare 79p a month, then that supports the podcast and gets you all that extra stuff as well. And so you can find out about that and everything else off the beatandtrackpodcast.com. That's off the beat and, not beaten, beatandtrackpodcast.com. Let's get on with it. Please enjoy today's episode of Off the Beaten Track Podcast with Napalm Death.
It's Off the Beaten Track Podcast on the Distraction Pieces Network. With me, Stu Whiffin.
Okay, we are recording. Shane, how are you today?
Not so bad, mate. A little grey over here in Birmingham. You know, took the kids to school, running around like a maniac, all that stuff. And, yeah, just trying to make sense of the day, which is, well, started already. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
It's Friday, so that's the end of the week. That's always a good thing. That's always a good thing.
Yeah, it can be, yeah.
Well, look, we always start the podcast by jumping straight into the playlist. And we start that by asking you, what song you regard as having the greatest ever intro, please, mate?
Well, all these, it's always hard, these kind of questions, but I would say from, I guess, through the years, from one, you know, getting into music earlier on, but Stargazer by Rainbow for me. Just because it's that crazy, Cozy Powell drum intro, you know, and you know, small village where I grew up and stuff, and summertime at my mate's house, you know, his mum used to, because they're from Birmingham originally, so his mum would go there to see his grandparents. And of course, she'd leave my friend Mitch and his brother in the flat for the weekend alone. So we'd be there rocking out metal and headbanging competitions, as it were. Stargazer was the one that was, can we make it to the end? And of course, I managed to make it to the end most of the time. It's just a great track, you know, it's amazing, really, for me.
The drumming in the intro is ridiculous. It's so good.
And when you hear that drum fill, it was like, wow, you know, here we go, and yeah. Everything else just keeps on getting better and better, really.
How important was, I mean, I'm sure we're going to talk about more of it as the podcast unfolds, but you've already sort of touched on them being from the Midlands and such. Like, how important and was the music from the Midlands for you growing up? Was it all around you? You know, was it something that you was kind of pushed to, like, look, these are from the Midlands. You need to check these out. You know, how did that sort of work for you?
Well, I think it's sort of always been, music was always around from my mum with the radio on all the time. You know, for her it was more the Beatles and stuff like that, really. But I think, you know, you that routine of coming home from school or whatever, watching Top of the Pops, Led Zeppelin was the theme tune for Top of the Pops in the 70s, and Slade were one of the bigger bands, you know, and of course they were just up the road for me. I was aware of where these places were, but I don't think I'd realised the gravity of that until much later in life. But you were, of course, you're surrounded, you know, Slade was there, and of course, through a mate of mine, his auntie gave us, we sold our souls for rock and roll, so I got into Sabbath that way, and of course, this was all around me, you know, and I believe Rob Alford's cousin was living in the village at the time, and there were little things like this, and of course, a Priest, and, you know, and Top of the Pops, I mean, especially in the late 70s, early 80s, metal was just, it was in the top 10 all the time. Like, yeah. I remember one time listening, thinking it was like, I think Motörhead and Girls' Score in there, then Motörhead Live was in there, then Saxon was in there, of course, a different town, but it was all around for me, metal, really. And of course, being a small village in Shropshire, Ironbridge, near Ironbridge, Broseley, of course, it's steeped in history too, and it's part of the Midlands as well, in some respects. It was quite close to West Midlands, and in hindsight, more so than ever now, I realised that I was kind of like baptised in heavy metal, I suppose. If you want to be, if you want to jump down that little cheesy kind of,
mate, I'm loving that.
Yeah, so I mean, pretty much that, really. The River Severn was there, and there we go. We like dunked in it, and there we go.
That needs to be on the CV. Baptised by metal.
I don't know, but what else did you say?
Pretty much.
So it was just, you know, I mean, Slade, I mean, a bit more rock and roll, of course, but still, you know, angry guitars and, you know, the Sweet. I love the Sweet. I just love the Flying V's and the double bass drums. It was like, oh, this is brilliant. I want some of this, you know.
Really. I'll tell you what, Shane, one of the things, like, I've done about 530 episodes of this podcast now, and the one band that constantly gets brought up is the Sweet. And for me, it was just growing up, it was they were like, I didn't put them alongside, Bowie and T-Rex. It didn't, in my head growing up, it was like they were just more like the sort of glam stuff like Mud and things like that. And it's only more recently that I've actually realised just how good they were.
Well, because the Sweet was like the obvious song blockbuster for me, but the B-side was incredibly heavy. Mm. And I got invited to, after his passing, went to John Peel's house to go through his archives to put a record box together. And I didn't quite know what a record box was for some reason, I don't know why. So the Slade album was there, and I was picking out stuff, and I went through his 7-inch collections. Of course, they were blockbuster. And I thought, let me just play the B-side, which I can't remember for the life of me what it is now. And was that guitar sound, is it still as... Because at the time, you've got to think how technology moves forward and the newest distortion pedal, and as albums got heavier and heavier. But still in the 70s, I was only, how old would I be, 6, 7? I remember going, bloody hell, that's a heavy guitar. Yeah. I remember saying that to myself, and my little old record player, my mum was going, it's pretty noisy. That's so, yeah, it's great, mum. And then I put it on John Peel had this little record turntable, and I said, God, the guitar sounds still heavy. 4 years later in this day and age, And the B-sides, I think some people would always play the A-sides, but I'd always play the B-sides too, because they tend to be better for me, a more representation of what the Sweet were doing, perhaps.
It's so interesting when you look back and you start to hear these kind of like little sort of, licks and riffs that you just see are the, are forming what's metal. And, for me, whenever I hear the opening, Stabs Have You Really Got Me by the Kinks, I just think, fucking hell, that's so heavy, so abrasive. And it's like, you can see it, where Aris manifested itself in and represent, and then re-emerges itself, within, the guitar lines in metal, you can hear it.
I think when you're attracted to, well, whatever you're attracted to, I guess, but when you, from a musical point of view, these things, especially at early age, I know from looking at my kids, those things kind of seep in, into their sort of method of processing stuff or whatever, but you hear these riffs. I mean, you look at again from the era, the Osmonds, if I know, but I love Crazy Horses because that riff was just fucking amazing.
What a record!
And they were pushing it a bit there, and I think I know Tank did a cover of Crazy Horses, mind blowing that was, and then it certainly. That got me going on that lovely guitar sound, it's just, you can hear it coming through, and I think, well, I remember I was slightly veering off, but with Metallica, of course, Metallica was something different, but then I remember sort of getting rid of a few heavy metal records and then becoming saddened that I'd done it and getting them back.
Yeah.
Realising that the Metallica were just a little bit faster than those bands, but it was just enough to kind of make you think it was totally different, but they were so into that early metal as well, and it's weird. And it sticks in your head, I think. Absolutely. Not sure I'm there, but I'm out of it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, Shane, I'm going to ask you for track two to tell me the first song you remember hearing that had an emotional impact on you, please.
I will do. And I think, that would be Junior's Eyes by Black Sabbath. I got into Sabbath through Never Say Die, and We Sell Our Souls for Rock and Roll. And of course, Never Say Die is kind of the last Aussie album at the time. And but I think there's a lot of emotion on that record for me, And Aussie's voice sounds really, really sad, And especially, and it's so mellow at the beginning, a really mellow bass line. Then when he comes in, I'm coming home again tomorrow. And I had this conversation with my friend Simon Effamy, who produces a few records for us and stuff. And we both freak out on the same part on that track. And he's just down the road in Stourbridge. He was. There's a lot of emotion on Never Say Die as an album, I think, I think when you make music, you are it's a way of sort of using emotions maybe you can't always say,
If you had to pinpoint the emotion that you felt hearing that for the first time, what would it have been?
Loneliness, I felt, to be fair. I think I go through this quite a lot with a few of my friends just chatting and stuff. But I look back at your childhood, and I like to think it was a happy childhood, but I think there was times when my parents weren't always there because they were working.
Yeah.
So all I had really was my music and, at the time, that, because, of course, the movies I loved to watch, which were my sort of more science fiction movies, they were on it, like once in a while. You had three or four channels, didn't you? It's not like now where it's bombardment, I guess. But I was a bit of loneliness. I felt connection with whoever Junior is. So I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
Also, Johnny Blade. That track Johnny Blade was another one which I loved.
Yeah.
I felt a bit of a connection between to both of them, these fictional characters in the songs, I felt. Yeah.
At a young age, was you getting lost in music then? Was that like a comforting thing to have if you was experiencing loneliness?
It was comforting. I mean, we had our friends, and of course, but when you're sort of early teens, and it wasn't that I didn't really drink. I mean, you could have. I mean, I looked my age, so I could get into a pub at the age of 15, have a couple of pints, but didn't really bother with that sort of thing because I was just more into Friday Rock Show would be on, and then the Merciful Fate would kick in, and I'd hear a bit of Satan's Fall, and I was like, man, this is mind-blowing. I'm loving this, a little tape recorder there, press record, make sure I got it. And Saturday mornings, I'd sit around with your mates going, look at this, listen to this band, Merciful Fate, and then I heard Venom. I remember my mum would come back, because it was a social club up the road, they'd come back, and I wouldn't hear them, because I'd be headphones on, and I'd be rocking out to, Highway to Hell, pretending to be Bon Scott, And who do you want to be Bon Scott, really, back in the day? It was definitely my kind of comfort zone.
Was it a strict diet of metal? Because, if we look at, if we're talking about the sort of late 70s, turn of the 80s, if that's around the time that we're sort of talking about, Shane, then it was, for me, I think, one of the most interesting times in music, because if you look at sort of 78, 79, 80, you've got the kind of tail end of punk, you've got post-punk, you've got what was going on in metal, you've got the two-tone thing that was exploding, you've got the sort of the tail end of like disco, you've got the early emergence of like new romantic music and synth music, and it was such a interesting time for music. If you watch an episode, you mentioned seeing episodes with Girls' School and stuff and Saxon on there, but then you're likely to see the Specials and Chic, and it was such an interesting time. So was other music interesting you at that point, or was it a sort of a tight diet of metal?
Well, I think I remember at the age you mentioned the Specials, Kate Bush was coming in,
of course,
Madness, Human League, all kinds of, and all my friends liked this at school, and we were kind of like, I think we all liked it all, but we were a little bit afraid to say it.
Yeah.
I was like, it's like my friend Mitch Dickinson, who was in a couple of bands with me, his brother loved Bowie and a lot of the sort of synth music, and so I'd be listening to Bowie through him, but I was really liking it, really. Mm. But there was that kind of immature-ish, I'm on into my metal, but it was all coming in because in latter years, when you get a bit older, you go, bollocks, this song, listen to what I want, and especially the 80s sort of new wave, new romantic stuff, definitely sort of makes even more sense to me now when I do my Dark Sky Burial stuff, which is more kind of like electronic.
Yeah.
The punks around me and the Sex Pistols going, oh, this is interesting, I like this, and I don't know. I think you go to school and it'd be all everyone be in their little factions.
It was so tribal, wasn't it then?
Yeah. It's not so much now, I don't think. But then it was, And I remember, instead of doing my maths, I did a poster for heavy metal logos. I mean, punk mate was going, look at you, bloody idiot. But we were really loving each other's music, and as we got more as the teens progressed, those boundaries kind of came down, I love a lot of that stuff now. It's amazing how much of it I remember.
Yeah.
Because it was on all the time, Adam and to be on blasting away, you know, tribal drumming going on. And that must have had an impact on me, because of course when I first heard Killing Joke, I'm like, listen to those tribal drums. Quite unrelated in some ways, but quite similar, I don't know. A lot of the, you know, the Human League or Visage or something like that, for example, you know, Japan, you know, still really great stuff. And this, to me now, of course, I'm like, it's all great, you know, but obviously, as you say, there was that tribalism when you were a kid. You're like,
yeah. But what's interesting is now, you know, as you said, it doesn't seem as tribal anymore. Like, you know, I've got two teenage daughters and it's just quite, everything's, I think, whether it's just because of how accessible all music is now, whether it be YouTube, Spotify, whatever, that you've got everything in a split second on your phone. Yeah. And I think back then you could only afford, you know, one record every couple of weeks or whatever it was. You get yourself a single and things like that. And I think what I've seen, you know, just over the years of running an alternative nightclub, is that lots of these tribes and scenes have disappeared, apart from metal. And metal is still one of the only, to my knowledge, maybe there's lots of other tribes that young people are doing that I've probably got no place in knowing about as a 50-year-old man. But for me, you will always see, you know, what tribe is more easily noticed than a metaller. A metaller's, you know, the uniform hasn't changed that much over the last 30, 40 years. It's still pretty much, you know, black metal t-shirt and, you know, long hair. And it's and I think metal's, as far as like youth culture and tribalness in scenes and music, I think it's completely consistently solid.
I think for a small period where that kind of classic denim cut off leather kind of disappeared. Not certainly not in Europe. It didn't. That was for sure.
Yeah,
it's come back tenfold over here again. I suppose. Yeah, I mean, it's true. It is. It's unmistakable, really. Where some of the scenes seem to have kind of melted into not one, but less obvious that kind of, but metal. Yeah, there's something about that. Imagery, I guess. Yeah, exactly. Everyone has to, particularly logo and their symbols and stuff. It's all about that, I think. But I don't know. I mean, there's obviously the subject matter lyrically can be dark in all forms of music.
Yeah.
More prevalent, supposedly, maybe in metal, and of course that is attached to symbolism and stuff like that. I guess to represent those kind of metaphors, I guess, in some ways. But it is interesting, and. But of course, everything is a bit more accessible now, you know. Visually probably not as tribal, but I wonder I have to ask my daughter to see how that's going on. Yeah. You know, I can sense how they're sort of splitting off into what they like and what they don't like, you know.
Sure.
I do obviously remember him from back when I was growing up, there was a real heavy, you know, I'm into this, you're into that kind of thing.
Yeah, definitely. Tell me the song while we're talking about these formative years.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 5% off your first purchase with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for 5% off your first purchase.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Shane, tell me the song that reminds you of your time at school, please.
Well, that was a tough one, to be fair. But then I thought really hard about it. And I thought, well, Our Friends Electric, or Two-Way Army, strangely enough, or Gary Newman, whichever you want to say, it kind of leads on well from what we were saying, because I was totally into my metal, but I fucking loved the synths on that track. It was like, I loved my sci-fi movies, or my Doctor Who films, or Tomorrow's People, all these vintage synths at the time, of course, which they were. And so I said, this sounds amazing, but that voice was very, very cold in a way, but piercing. And again, whilst I was loving my metal, I just couldn't help but love the rhythm of this. I think a lot of electro music is very, 4/4 or whatever.
And it chugs, doesn't it? It chugs, and it's fucking heavy.
I think that's probably what it was, and it's just like, even like nowadays, I listen to some of that stuff, and I'm like, listen to the power of those synths. Yeah. It's amazing. That's the forerunner of industrial music. It must be
100%.
It must be. Of course, my friend was a massive tune, which says he'd always be playing it, and I'd be like, "Well, let's listen to that." And I'd be like, I'm sure you said, "I really love this," and just said bollocks to it, but I was a bit like in a corner sheepish, with my Saxon shirt on. so to speak. But no, that really reminds me, just in the classroom, you get those times where you could bring a bit of your music in to play and stuff like that. And she brought it to my friend Angela, who's back in the village still. She'd bring that into play, amongst other things. And I'm like, "Oh, this aria, like this is a really powerful, radio and stuff." And of course, once you start getting into that, you look at the Human League or Spandau Ballet or whichever. There's one thing, I always forget the name of the artist, and so I started getting into all the synthesizer stuff, and there's this track called Einstein and Go-Go.
Yeah, of course.
And I loved that track. Loved it. It's just so manic, And of course, I think that was responsible for me getting into other stuff, the kind of quirky keyboards. Loved it. And I went out, Spotify or whatever, so I was like, who did that? Landscape is the band. That's right. Landscape, and I'm like, I love that. And it was, you start making it, you start putting two and two together, really.
And it's so true. You talk about the influence that Newman had, on the industrial scene, because you later see him joining Trent Reznor on stage and performing with Nine Inch Nails, who have long championed Gary Newman as a big influence. And I love joining those sort of dots.
It's great.
Your KMFDMs and your Nitzerebs and that, they were all absolutely sort of, I think a lot of them will probably tip their cap to Kraftwerk, for being electronic pioneers, but I think in regards to bringing that hardness and them thick sounding synths, I think Newman was the pioneer there, and you're right, that coldness to his voice, that's a really important part.
I think when you say joining the dots, because I find, can I explain? It's hard to explain this correctly, or whatever. But you get to a rock, into my metal. But if you love music, which I think it's what it was. It was loving the music, because on the sideline, all this stuff was coming in. And so now I'm forever going, oh, I just, you know, I'll remember a band from the 70s or 80s. And then I'll go, oh, who was that member? Then I'll see where he went. And I'll, oh, he did this. Oh, when he worked with him.
Yeah.
Oh, I love all this. And then I go, oh, who's that? Not over that band. And I'll just click on it. It's fucking amazing too. And
it's like 4 hours later.
Yeah, 4 hours later. It's a little musical anthropology thing going on, really, you know. And it's brilliant. And it's, and I love it. You know, I love Japan. So what's David Sylvian doing now? Who's doing this? So, oh, it's pretty quirky, that is, when he worked with so-and-so. Then I see these quotes where Brian Eno and Bowie working together, and they got a new synthesizer, and they threw the manual at the window, and I thought, well, I like that, because I fucking can't stand manuals myself. I should have a dive and see what goes on. And I'm like, I find it all really, really nice and inspiring, to be honest. You know, that some of these people who made great music will probably, you know, seeing what happens, like we try and do, you know. My daughter comes back from school and she's like, oh, I've got to learn the guitar, Dad. Can you teach me a guitar chord? I'm like, I fucking don't. I couldn't tell you what it is. I could tell you the chord. I don't know exactly what it is. You know, then I'm like, oh, what's going on here? But So all that stuff's really good, the joining of the dots. I love it, you know.
What, you know, we're talking about a song that soundtracked your years at school. Tell me about school. Did you enjoy it?
I think the sort of 5 to 11 period, I really enjoyed it. There's a couple of teachers I connected with. You know, there was the one teacher who'd be like, well, today we're studying so-and-so. Why are you drawing a picture of Spider-Man climbing up the wall? And I'm like, well, but whereas the other teacher was quite encouraging of that kind of escapist sort of whatever, you know. I went to secondary school, and I think it was all right at first, I guess. You know, always you get the initial fear because you're going to a bigger school. And then, you know, you're in the tails back then, of course. Oh, yeah, you're going to get your head flushed down the toilet. And I'm like, bloody hell, I'm not there with this. And, of course, that never happened. But made a lot of friends there, really. But because it was only about, again, village area, it was only 4 miles away. And I think after the third year, there was a little bit of bullying going on from some people. I was quite big at school, hair, you know, that kind of vibe. And, you know, you're into your metal, and in my year, everyone was pretty cool, but there's a few above me, were a little bit, you know, a bit mean, really, and I took it a bit personally, and not just me, a couple of my other mates as well. So, of course, you couldn't do this now, but, you know, we'd sign into the register, and then we'd just walk home,
yeah.
You know, which is what we do, and get collared, like, you know, it was art yesterday, it was really good. Well, that's strange, because Mr. So-and-so saw you kicking a bloody football in the field down the road, you know, detention for a month, and that was that. But I don't think, I mean, ultimately, you know, I'm sorry, I don't think it was that bad. I mean, these are the things you have to deal with, but you stand your ground and try and be who you are. Yeah. See, I find it now, as being a father, with today's standards and pressures on children, for me, it's a bit hard to relate, because I mean, I'm lucky enough to I've done what I did and here where I am, but I don't take it for granted. So it's hard to translate that in a family setting, you know, I guess, because my wife's a bit more academic, I suppose, than me in some ways, whatever that means. And so it gets interesting conversations sometimes there to try and say the most beneficial thing for my daughter to move forward, you know, really. But it was all right, I guess. I mean, in the end, I mean, yeah, I think a lot of people, we get bullied and stuff, when you say you come through it, really, I guess.
Absolutely. Tell me the first song you remember buying from a record shop, please, Shane.
And that would be Slade, again. Literally 5 minutes from where I lived, there was a bicycle shop / record shop. That was what it was. So you get
there. Were so many hybrid shops, wasn't there? It was a toy shop that sold records.
Oh, brilliant. And yeah, there was a news. And I also remember later on, the news agent down the road, that's where I bought the 4 solo Kiss albums from.
Yeah.
$1.99 each. I was like, I'm having them, all of them. But, in the early, so I'd go in, and I think at the time the Slade movie might have come out, perhaps at the time. Was it Slade movie? I think it was a Slade movie, or am I confusing it with someone else?
It's Slade in Flames.
In Flames, that's it, yeah. So the track album was there. I think, but Goodbye to Jane was there, the singer. I remember. I mean, Mum used to buy me a Slade single every week, every other week. It seemed like there was always a new one, or maybe I was just catching up. I don't know at the time. You know, you remember it's a bit vague at those times. But so it was Goodbye to Jane, and I had a little, Jane got me a little one speaker box thing, you know, you put your records on, you know. And so that was the first kind of 7-inch I got, really. You know, I'm not going to count Rupert Bear, really. You know what I mean? It doesn't really count, does it? You know?
But I mean, the thing is with Slade, it's like, I'm so glad that they kind of had, you know, that absolute sort of boom in the, you know, I guess coming out of glam and into the 80s. And I think it was Oasis that would cover Come On, Feel the Noise in the 90s. And I remember Noel Gallagher, you know, saying that Slade was like one of the biggest influences on Oasis ever. He said that, it was one of my favourite quotes ever from him. He said, yeah, they wrote proper geezers tunes, but looked like fucking Diddy men. And I thought...
Those are the classic cats. That was that kind of weird larger than life, or you know, Diddy meant smaller than life, I suppose. Yeah. But it's
what a voice Noddy Alder's got.
It was great. Well, it was powerful and commanding, wasn't
so
it?
So good.
You know, and I don't know, something about those watching Tell the Pops as a kid, you know, and just like, I don't know. Like a gathering when they were just jumping around, and you know, the crazy shaped guitars, and I loved it every week. You know, my dad was a bit more kind of, he loved it. He used to play in like brass bands and stuff. So to him, it was a bit like he didn't get it, but my mom loved it. She thought it was really good, and so I got the support from there. But you know, there was the sweet, of course, but yeah, that I seemed like I was getting for a while. It seemed like I was getting a Slade 7-inch almost every other week.
Yeah,
and so I was like, yeah, right.
As you said, if you was, you know, you was a kid that was into sci-fi and stuff like that, you know, when you'd look at Dave Hill or the Sweet, they looked like they were beamed down from fucking space, didn't they?
There was that. Well, because, and you see it now, I suppose, but it was very. In the 70s, the colourful, it was colourful, wasn't it? You know, everything was odd shapes, and he had specially making guitars, and I was like, this is amazing. And, but yeah, you're right, like, it's almost like a live version of Banana Splits,
yeah,
you know, I suppose. It was great, yeah, to me, and just but it picked you up, and I think that's, everyone comes from different angles with their music or what they want to do, I suppose, but I like. I teeter between the darkness and the light a lot. So, but you know, I do like songs that pick me up. I love a track that's going to go like, oh, I felt a bit miserable 5 minutes ago, but I feel absolutely chuffed now. That's always good, you know. So, and Slade did that for me. You know,
I'm always interested to know, like, how people, if they, you know, they wake up and they're feeling shit, and what their sort of reach out is for that, because for me, if I'm feeling pretty rubbish, like, I will kind of immerse myself in it. I'll drag out some Nick Cave records and a bit of Leonard Cohen, and I'll just wallow in it for a little bit. You know, do you sort of...
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Do that, or you know, as you mentioned there, we said, will you put on something more up and try and sort of, you know, use it to pull yourself?
I think sometimes, or like most of the time, depending on who you are as a person, I know that, and this, I've battled this more so the past few years. I am a bit of an escapist, you know, so sometimes, no one, because people, I think most of us are. Reality, sometimes you go, oh God, not today.
That's overrated, mate.
Yeah, sometimes you go, not in it this morning. And I was a bit of a mood this morning, to be fair, actually, honestly. And I went down to, dropped my kids off. I mean, a mate of mine, Carvers, who plays in Gong, and sent me a new Gong video. And I was like, fucking hell, this is amazing. And then within 5 minutes, I was like, boom, big old beamy smile, chuffed, you know. I said, mate, you just tell you made my morning, you know.
Fantastic.
How can you explain that 100%? It's just that it is always a balance, and we have to get in the doldrums of whatever normal things. But a bit of good music will pick you up, because more in tune with who you are, I suppose. Yeah, really, yeah. But we all have to shuffle along, and you know. But yeah, it's a bollock sometimes. It's just whatever, you just want to rock out, to be honest. That's what I think, you know. And sometimes you have to, and then you feel better. Yeah, you know, then after now, you go, you know, what was I moaning about?
Yeah.
Feel better.
And so tell me a little bit now, as we kind of sort of get out of school and into the daunting real world. Tell me a little bit about how this kid that would lose himself in heavy metal records found himself in Napalm Death.
Because of the sort of quest, as we sort of talked about with music, from heavy metal, I discovered Venom, bought their record, and that sort of blew my mind. And then one of my best friends, Mitch Dickinson, he played in Heresy's old hardcore band for a while. And good bands with him. His stepbrother was into punk rock, so he got me into Dead Kennedys, Exploited. So they started crossing over, you know, through the mid-80s. Magazine called Metal Forces. Back of that, I had like the pen pal thing. So I saw Bill Steer's name, who joined Napalm. He's also a Carcass guitarist name. He introduced me to a bunch of other bands through tape trading. And then I got the call. Then we got invited to go to a pub called The Mermaid, which is just up the road from me in Birmingham. It's not there anymore. It's called something else. Napalm Death were playing alongside a bunch of bands. So I saw Napalm Death March 86. Floored me. I was like, this is the best band I've ever seen. Became really good friends with them and started to hang out with them. You know, the joys of... I was working at the time, quit my job. I said, I'm going to the Dole. I'm going to hang out with my mate Mickey, the drummer. My dad goes, what? You're not even joining the band? I says, well, maybe, hopefully at some point. I said, but not at the moment. I'm going to hang out with him in Brum. It's fun. And I used to go to gigs and all that kind of stuff. And then eventually got asked if I'd want to join after the first album came out. There was a period I could have joined in between A and B of the first album, but it got a bit, I think I lost my bottle, really. And then finally joined just after the record came out, you know. But all that scene that was happening here in 86, 87, hardcore punk, I guess, but they were starting to cross over into some death metal stuff that I liked, and everything was kind of meshing, you know. I introduced some of them to the tape trading scene that I was involved with, the States and everywhere else, and all of a sudden we had our scene to promote over there too. So it was a really good way of networking, you know. And then that was it. I was in on bass, you know, so had some songs.
How was them early shows? How did it feel sort of, you know, being in the band that you was, you know, a huge fan of?
The strangest thing is we did a John Peel session before I'd even played a gig. So that was nerve-wracking because... in the Maida Vale studios are very, very huge corridors. Remind me of some Doctor Who episode, actually. But so that was nerve-wracking because all of a sudden you're on radio. I was like, this is totally bizarre. kind of all dreamed of in a way, but it's still bizarre. And then we eventually played, I think, a show in Nottingham, a club called The Garage, which is, I don't think there anymore. Supported a band called DRI. And that was kind of nerve-wracking because my friend Jimmy used to play bass in Napalm, was in the front row rocking out. And I was going, well, this is a bit odd, you know. I think because we rehearsed a little bit, but not loads, because I think people marvel at the fact that something we just seemed to be able to do what we did. And we weren't practicing every day. It was like once in a while and just getting together when we could. We just did what we did. And the songs were a bit more basic back then. But you do it and you'd sit there and wonder what just happened, I think. You know, for the first few gigs, I was like, what just happened? Mm. Yeah, we're loving it, but I don't think we could really process the reaction. You know, everything that was going on at that time around Napalm just seemed weird. Really good, but odd, surreal, I suppose.
Was you a confident teen?
No. I wasn't very. I was always a bit. I still am a little bit. I can go on. I mean, I can go on stage and play 200,000 people, but I get nervous walking in Sainsbury's.
That's what I was going to ask. Like, you know, how do you kind of sort of, you know, as you said, you wasn't confident. Like, there must have been a period of, you know, as the band got bigger and bigger, was it a gradual thing of all of a sudden, right, look, we're not playing in this sort of small, you know, venue, we're now playing this venue, oh, we're now supporting this band, and it's gotten bigger and bigger and bigger. Was it a gradual thing that you got more used to sort of being on stage in front of, you know, huge crowds, or, you know, and also tell me, have you got a little routine for you that you do before you walk on stage?
I think you will gradually get used to it. And I think in the earlier days, I don't think Lee and Bill were ever totally comfortable with it. And I think that's a small part of the reason why they decided to move on. Other reasons as well. But you did become more comfortable. I became more comfortable when Jesse and Mitch joined Napalm Death. Mm. Because, I mean, this is the old Napalm house. Danny Adrum's downstairs. But we all lived here for years, and that boosted my confidence. I don't want to go into some mad psychological rant, but they became brothers, you know, to me, and it was a family. And so that helped my confidence a little bit, in a way. We were there for each other, really, and we liked playing shows live, and it was getting bigger and stuff. And but then, of course, you can get swept away by that if you're not careful. You know, this is the mask you wear, or you've been in a band or whatever. But of course, you've got to come back to reality. And sometimes in the 90s, it was very hard to, because you come off a tour, a couple of shows, and then, like, oh, tomorrow, Jane's Addiction's playing down the road, or 2 days' time, Chili Peppers are playing, or Sonic Youth playing. And also at the time in the early 90s, I became friends with Billy from Faith No More. They were taking off, and, you know, I'd read the back, oh, the guy from Jesus Jones likes Napalm. I like Jesus Jones. I'll go and say hello to them. And all this really great stuff was going on, you know, Wonder stuff were playing, and I was terrible just for going out. So it's really hard to come back down to earth sometimes, yeah. You know. It's great, but...
Because at that point, Stuffies and Neds, they were all Midlands bands, blowing up big time, weren't they?
And the other guys in Napalm as well, because we just lived in this very house. Yeah, we would just play, the stereos would be on.
Yeah.
Different, and we'd just be loving each other's music, you know. And, I remember going, we went drinking to this club called Tracine's in Brum on a Monday night, and then I think Rat from Ned's was there, Graham from the Poppies was there. Graham jumped on my back, and I fell on him. I thought I'd killed him. He was all right. Oh, my God, you know.
Don't even think of the Poppies, of course.
And of course, Simon, who FME is our sound engineer, but producer, he produced Paradise Lost, Amorphous Records, Wild Arts, but good mate of mine way back in the day. We're both metalers. Of course, he works with the Stuffies, you know, works with the Poppies from Stairbridge. All these mad connections, you know. And so, yeah, we come off tour. It's really hard to bring it down. And now, when I get older, I'm older. It's a little bit different now. Because I have my family, and it's very hard to balance it. You know, I have to. My wife's very good at telling me that, you know, you're not on bloody stage and that sort of thing, you know, sort of so to speak. And, earlier on, I mean, I was quite nervous, really. And it is hard to, because I'm lucky to and privileged to be doing what I'm doing, what I've always wanted to do, but you still hope to think that you're reasonably down to earth, as you can be.
Of course.
So, it's a strange one.
That sort of scene that we've just spoke about there, from Faith No More to James, that's like my golden age of being. I was about 19 then, and it was everything and more, everything that was exploding in music at that point. As somebody that loved metal, and we see, certainly with the two bands you've mentioned there, took it in different directions. You know, Faith No More, for me, one of the greatest bands I've ever walked this planet, and I'll probably say the same for Jane's Addiction. And tell me what it was like seeing them bands early on, in their sort of embryonic stages, them first sort of like tours, and seeing the craziness that was Jane's, and the same with Faith No More. And were you fans of that kind of,
I think that was the thing for me before Mitch and Jess came over and joined the band. But there was Sands, there was NME, and I used to, of course, we were apart, we would get featured on NME, but I'd go, who is this band called Jane's Addiction? I thought Sands is so, but nothing shocking. I wasn't aware of the live album that came out before at first. Well, of course, once I find out that I have to have everything, and that's how I am. But I loved it, and it was the same with Faith No More before Mike joined the band. I got into Faith No More for the second album through my friend's their brother. And so I got to see them in the earlier days, and it was just, there was the same energy for me. And I started off as a drummer briefly originally and then moved on, but loved the rhythms. And that was the thing when Napalm tried to move in different directions. We always kept the heaviness, but we loved those beats of Jane's or the Pump Touching Pumpkins or whatever. We found them just exciting. But yeah, watching them was great in the early days. I went to stay with Mitch back home in Vegas, and we went to see Jane's Addiction at the Hollywood Blade in 3 days in a row. And I think it was Jane's. I think who played it was Primus.
Primus,
Pixies, the Primus, and Jane's Addiction. All three bands I loved. I remember I went into this pit, into the pit for Jane's Addiction, and this guy grabbed me. This Mexican, he goes, "You're the guy from Napalm Death." He said, "Yeah," and he threw me back in. And after 3 seconds, I was like, "I'm never going in the pit ever again." I was at the age of about mid-20s. It's just insanely crazy. I mean, yeah. Jane's, Jane's, musically probably different from Napalm, but the reaction to them was just insane.
Yeah.
Becoming friends with the guys from Faith No More after loving them too much was really nice, Billy's lovely. They're all lovely guys. We managed to play a couple of shows with them a few years.
Incredible.
And just like they're most courteous, lovely people, really, and the 90s, I loved it. All these new bands coming out. I was like, let me check My Bloody Valentine and see what they're all about. Let me check Sonic Youth there. And I loved it all.
You mentioned two bands there that are two of my favourite bands. I guess what you could say about both, Loveless and Daydream Nation or Dirty, it is just a sonic assault of glorious noise, isn't it?
It's great stuff, and to me it was, I've tried to, and I've hopefully succeeded to try and incorporate that into Napalm over the years.
Yeah.
To meld it with what Napalm does. And say, I'd sit there, what's Thurston Moore doing? Of course they had lots of different two-string guitars. I didn't know this at the time. So I was trying to play what Thurston's doing. I'm like, how the hell am I doing this? But so you do your own thing, of course, Killing Joke and Geordie and all that great. I try to bring that into Napalm, but My Bloody Valentine, I was like, how the hell? It sounds like it's slowing down. It's being slowing down. When you're partying a little bit, so to speak, you're going, bloody hell, this is woo. And, but killer. And all that stuff, it would soak into my brain to come out in other ways, I suppose, years later, I guess. All amazing bands, and saw them live, and it's just great,
You talk partying, so let's get track five in. That's the song that soundtracked your years partying.
Well, it would be the She Sells Sanctuary by The Cult, I think.
I was just going to, I don't mean to interrupt you there, but that record, Shane, right, if that come out tomorrow, no one would know that was nearly 40 years old, because it still sounds so fresh, so vital, so fucking incredible. What a record, right?
It's lots of energy, you know. And coming from, because you're getting into some of the hardcore punk bands, and a lot of those, some of those punk bands, obviously Oscar Du or Bangle 7 Seconds, started to become more melodic, and that was my stepping stone. And my friends said, well, check out this band, The Cult. And I love jangly guitars. Yeah, I love just the hook lines, you know. And The Cult has loads of them, like The Mission does as well, you know. And I love all that stuff. And the nightclubs, isn't it? There's been a club called Edwards Number 8 in Brum, and on a Thursday, Friday, you know, we'd be there for, and Saturday sometimes, just like, you know, just the hook line to that track is, and it goes off. It's like, well, you know, yeah. it means business. It does. It's amazing, you know. And many a night, you know, just standing there at my mind, you're afraid to talk to someone because I'm too shy. And you go back to me, mate, well, I'm sure she liked me. You're too bollocks to talk, weren't you? I said, yeah. So, well, they played it, and Cult was on, of course, and that'd be it. You know, that was what it was, you know. It was brilliant.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I'm going to take you home for this one, Shane. And for track 6, a favourite song from an artist from your home county, please.
That was a real tricky one, to be fair, and I had to think about it, and I thought the band Baby Bird, all things, because I remember I said, I'm like, who can I think, and it was Tapao, and I thought, well, no, I'm not really a Tapao fan, but I did like Baby Bird. That one album, was really jangly, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realise they were from a guy from Telford until much later. But around about that 90s again, I think it was mid 90s.
It was,
I just I suppose because we'd also what we'd do that we all three of us together, we'd have our session, and the midweek it would be in this place called Snobs, more studenty. So that was always on. And I get confused for thinking it was another band at one point. Yeah. And I thought, no, it's not them. And I thought, oh, maybe. And so, when you asked me this question, I was like, it was a bit of a tricky one to think about. And I thought, oh, there you go. That was good. It was great.
It's, Baby Bird, I mean, it's essentially Steve. I can't remember Steven's second name. Escapes me. But he's prolific at releasing records, like they just come thick and fast, and I think he's such an underrated artist. I think, you know, people just go, oh, what, the guy that sang You're Gorgeous, and it's like, oh, there's, I mean, just check the album out. That album's fantastic.
Yeah, the album's great.
And he's done so much more since then as well. And he just, don't know. I don't know if the music press fell out of love with him. I don't know, but he just seemed to.
I think the album that came after that was a little bit different from that.
It was, yeah.
I think sometimes how the press can be or whichever, they can be quite fickle, you know. Mm. And now you've told me that bit. I need to go and check out some other stuff that he's done there. Now you've told me that, because that's again the stepping stone thing. I'll have to have a look. But yeah, that can happen. Something, I mean, you can get noticed for one particular thing, because there's some great tunes on there, but and it's reflective of the time, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And then, of course, the second album, well, it's not the second album, but the other album after this is a bit different. Yeah. And maybe it was why. He just wants to do something different, I suppose. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not always popular with some people when you want to do your own thing. I don't know, whatever. You know.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Well, look, this is the last track now, Shane. And this is a song that you think many people may not know, that you would like them to hear, please.
Well, I think if I can get this, my brain is, there we go, bear with me. Oh, hold on a minute. My phone is frozen up and I've got to jog my memory. Here we go. Oh, well, of course, it's that, isn't it? Sorry, is this the Life by Cardiac?
Okay. Tell me about the Cardiacs, because they seem to be music's best kept secret, and so many people don't know about them. Tell my listeners why people should go and explore the Cardiacs.
Because I think, a lot of people don't know about them, but they just you either get them or you don't get them. But if you get them, they become such an important part of your life. I think there's so much emotion within their music. And Is This the Life is a little bit more, I suppose, if there's ever a word, mainstream for them, because a lot of the stuff is quite eclectic in sounds, punky, proggy, which kind of goes on from when we talked about stuff like the Specials or Madness earlier.
Yeah.
The elements of ska that go through the Cardiacs, but also so much other stuff. So much, yeah. I just find them a beautiful band, you know, and a band that, if it's going to be a band that's going to cheer you up, it's going to be the Cardiacs. It's going to make you smile and make you feel that, you know, life's worth living and it's good, you know. I got to be friends with the guys and the wonderful people. Timmy unfortunately passed away a few years back, but I suppose in some ways people who know me, they probably know that I love the Cardiacs, I guess, but it's just genius, really, and I don't think anyone come close to capturing their majesty, I guess.
Absolutely. Shane, we spoke about so many other people's music. Let's talk about what you're up to. What's happening?
Let me think. I've got, obviously, I'm up to, on my Bandcamp, I've got up to my 8th Dark Sky Burial album already, which is kind of sort of soundscapey, soundtracky. It's, you know, me sort of meandering through my synths, and it's a bit of a therapy for me, really. Earlier this year, a band called Venomous Concept, which is a kind of punky project I have with the guy from Brutal Truth. Mm-hmm. And we released that record on Graphite Records earlier called The Good Ship Lollipop, a bit more different from what the earlier albums, a bit more mid-paced.
Okay.
And then I've got a few other various projects sort of bubbling under. I've got something I've just finished where it's more kind of in that semi sort of industrial kind of cardiac dance movement. It's what it does musically, it encompasses a lot of everything. The 80s stuff that we talked about, you know, sure. Me and Sam, we were recording it, and I haven't decided the name of it yet, really, but I've started singing on this as well, and actual singing. So it's very, very different for what I've done before. But that's one of them things you'll hear it and go, oh, I hear a bit of that.
And yeah.
Meshed in and squished. Now, a lot of that 80s stuff that we talked about is in there, mixed in with the guitars and,
yeah.
You know, bit of a sort of confessional album. My friend always tells me he thinks it's the past few years of, you know, pandemic post, yeah. Working my life out kind of stuff. And then, of course, I'm putting stuff together for the next Napalm album, which will be, I hope we can start it first quarter next year, really. And there's a couple of other things going on, but nothing that's coming out as yet. It's just I'm here with me synth and me guitars, and I'm always popping away at something, really. Yeah.
Shane, if people want to keep up to speed with all of these projects and everything that's happening with you, where's the best place to sort of keep up to speed, mate?
Well, it's probably the Instagram, which is like Shane Napalm, I think it is.
Yeah.
And that's about the best one, where I tend to be reasonably active, you know, and stuff at the moment, doing the book thing, which is interesting. Just to do that, it's a bit different for me, really.
But how's that been as an experience?
It's been good. I mean, it came at the right time, I think. I think when the pandemic hit, you know, we didn't know what we were doing, really. And I was like, God, I've never been home for more than 6 weeks. And so I was doing that, and then it was offered, would you like to do a book? I'm like, well, it's something creative. I'll, and so I managed to have a reasonable memory for it all, you know. And doing this, it's been nice. It's nice to talk about music. This is great. This is what I like to talk about. I mean, Napalm tends to be a little bit different, whereas Bond is a lot of the press, so lyrically, it's more lyrically based, which is cool. But I love to talk about music. That's me, you know, and what fires creativity, you know, and stuff. So the book's been good for doing interviews exactly like this, you know, so it makes me happy, really.
Fantastic. Shane, if it's all right with you, then I'll tag you in all the posts about this episode on Instagram. So if people aren't following you already, then they can do so.
Yeah, sure. I think I've heard there's a Facebook thing which is Shane T. Embry, I think it is.
Okay.
You'll find me. There's two. There's me. Well, it's not even personal, but yeah, Shane T. Embry, I guess.
We'll tag you in everything, mate. Shane, it's been a real delight talking records, and it's been a beautiful surprise, because I think when I initially saw the email that you was doing press, I thought, oh, this is going to be incredible. I did not think I'd be talking about synth pop and Sonic Youth with Shane from Black Park Death. It's been lovely.
Love all that stuff. It's never ending, the journey through music, and that's what I love. It's always discovering something new.
Absolutely, absolutely.
It's great.
Shane, I'm going to press stop, but don't go anywhere.
Right, mate. Got you.
Oh, how delightful was that? What an absolute top lad Shane was. And who thought we'd be speaking Jane's Addiction, My Bloody Valentine, Human League, Gary Numan. Your preconceptions of people, are always wrong. Always wrong. And it's the beautiful thing when you get talking to people that are obsessed with music, that the stuff that they're famous for is not necessarily always super representative of the stuff that they listen to. That was an absolutely delightful chat. And even got to chat about my favourite scene, that early 90s scene. Got to talk about, if you're from the Midlands, how could you not, in the early 90s be obsessed with the Stuffies and Neds and such? So, wonderful, wonderful chat. As mentioned at the beginning, if you'd love to, say thank you, then the best way you can is to go over to the link in the show notes to buy me a coffee. You can just go over there and buy me a coffee. I love a cup of coffee. That sounds crazy, but just click the link. Alternatively, I'd love it if you become a Patreon and support the podcast. Like I say, it's $1 a month, and you get loads of extra stuff for that as well. But ultimately, you are supporting the podcast, which is a labour of love. And I hope I've kept you entertained for well over 500 episodes. So, and as also mentioned at the beginning, if this is your first time listening, go and explore that back catalogue. You've got loads of catching up to do. We mentioned the one stuff just a moment ago there. Had a fantastic chat with Miles Hunt a few years ago. And I think we mentioned Jesus Jones on the podcast. I've been really lucky to have keyboard breaker Ian Baker of Jesus Jones on the podcast, and so many other incredible artists. And if you like your noisy stuff, then I've had Tommy Lee and Motley Crue, and I've had Mastodon on, I've had Enter Shikari, and I can't think, it was Papa Roach, who else have I had on? Judas Priest. I've had some absolute bangers, and they're all there to be enjoyed for free. I'll be back next time. In the meantime, be nice to each other. I will see you soon. Bye-bye.